Welcome to Scotist Cast, No Machines Here Edition. Thank you for tuning in. On November 9th, 2009, the Supreme Court heard oral argument in Bilski v. Capose. The issue in this case is whether a process must be tied to a particular machine or apparatus or transform a particular article into a different state or thing in order to be eligible for patenting under 35 United States Code Section 101. To discuss the decision, we have University of Chicago School of Law and New York University Law School Professor Richard A. Epstein. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Epstein.
Hi, this is Richard Epstein, and I'm here to talk about the recent argument held in the United States Supreme Court about one of the most important patent cases to come before that court in recent years. The name of the case is In re Bilski, and it deals with a question which sounds quite technical, but which in fact is of immense importance for the way in which the patent system is organized. On its face, the particular question that was raised in Bilski does not seem to be particularly exciting. The question was whether or not a party which developed a theory or a practice or a method for hedging risk in the field of commodities trading was entitled to patent that particular risk. I haven't given a very long description of what that particular patent was, because for this particular point, it really doesn't matter. The question was whether or not this kind of patent, these so-called business method patents, are in fact subject to any kind of patent protection, or whether they have to be protected either by trade secrets or go totally unprotected. Clearly, the question of whether or not some kind of activity can be brought within the scope of the patent law is one of immense importance. The way in which this thing has to be argued is in relationship, of course, to the particular language of the patent statute. And that itself has two separate tests that one has to go through, one of which is the categorical and the other is the particular. And at the categorical level, the basic section, Section 101, says, whoever invents or discovers any new or useful process, machine, manufacture, or composition of matter, or any new and useful improvement thereof, is entitled to a patent. And so one of the key questions is, what is meant by the term process, machine, manufacture, or composition? If, in fact, somebody manages to pass through that particular hurdle, then there are other tests that have to be solved, of which the most important one is whether or not this particular invention is sufficiently non-obvious to merit patent protection. And what happens is there is a test which reads roughly as follows. The question you have to ask is whether the subject matter as a whole would have been obvious at the time the invention was made to a person having ordinary skill in the art to which said invention subject matter pertains. And so the basic point here is you've got a twofold situation. You have first a highly generalized question whether or not certain kinds of inventions are brought within the system, and then in a particular case, the purpose of the non-obviousness test is to ask whether or not the benefit of patent franchise is going to be given to somebody who has only made a modest improvement over the previous status quo, and the answer to that question as a generic matter is no. Now, in looking at these two questions, the first of them is categorical, the second of them is highly particularistic. So somebody could take the view with respect to these business method patents, which essentially don't involve any kind of physical transformation of some subject matter out there in the world at large, or whether it be a piece of steel on the one hand or an electron of another, is whether they are so unworthy of protection that we're going to rule them out as a class. And if, in fact, you make the negative judgment on that particular case, nobody could thereafter come forward and say, aha, this particular patent application is really very different because the business method that it's designed to cover is enormously useful. So once you flunk on the question of patent eligibility, you never get to the individuated requirement on obviousness. If, in fact, you pass the test of patent eligibility, you then have to address that question on a case-by-case basis. Now, in dealing with this particular issue, therefore, the nature of these two steps have to be kept in mind. And one of the things that was actually kind of disturbing about the way in which the Supreme Court argued or asked questions about this case is that they did not seem, the judges, to be fully appreciative of the way in which these two parts of the patent system work sensibly together. The case was rather unusual in the sense that Michael Jakes, arguing for the petitioner, that is, for Bilski trying to seek the patent, constantly in response to questions said, well, Your Honor, I'm not quite sure whether or not this particular invention would be patented because you have the obviousness requirement. And the Supreme Court justices kept on asking questions as if you could find some kind of funny hypothetical which showed the absurdity of a patent, that would refute the question on patent eligibility. So, for example, Judge Sotomayor asked the question as to whether or not speed dating would be patentable, and Justice Breyer asked the question as to whether or not a method by which he could keep his antitrust class awake in school would be patentable. And the answer that Mr. Jakes kept on trying to give is, these things may be perfectly obvious and so therefore are not patentable, but you can't show the inutility of patenting the larger class by showing that there are some particular absurd examples that fall within it. That's the office of the non-obviousness test to get rid of. It's not the office of patent eligibility. When the case turned over to the government, and it was represented by the Deputy Solicitor General, Malcolm Stewart, he actually wanted to lose this case, at least in part. One of the most interesting features about the way in which Bielski was argued was the sheer number of amicus briefs that were written in it. And by way of full disclosure, Scott Keefe and myself wrote one of these things for Mr. Chakrabarty, who in fact was the winner in a case called Diamond against Chakrabarty, which announced a very broad test of patent eligibility, meaning it covers just about anything under the sun. But the import of a lot of the briefs that were written by amicus parties weren't concerned only with the question about business method patents. Many people started to say, if you have one of these physical transformation tests, we're not quite sure of the status of computer programs that you're going to have, or biotechnology patents, or genetic engineering, or all sorts of other things done in the information sciences. And so you get this odd position of the government hoping to win a particular case without submarining the entire apparatus for which intellectual property has been developed in collateral fields. So you had this very odd way in which the two sides were pretty much in agreement with respect to a large portion of what we would want to call the patent space, and disagreeing mainly with respect to these business method patents. What I think was failed to come out in the course of the argument is how you want to look at the field as a whole, as opposed to the way in which you want to look at the particular case that's involved here. And if you start to look at the field as a whole, one of the things is that there was a fair degree, not of unanimity, but a fairly large consensus on the part of many academics, like myself, that broad patent eligibility should be encouraged. As I mentioned, Scott Keefe and myself wrote one brief. Mark Lemley was the author of another brief, and Lemley has clashed with Keefe and myself on a number of issues, having, for example, to do with such questions as to whether or not you like injunctive relief in patent cases, which Keefe and I support, he tended to impose, or what kinds of tests you would want to use for measuring obviousness. I'm in favor of more structured tests. Lemley tends to go the opposite way on that question. And what happens, therefore, is you now find both of us coming back together and saying, you really can't draw any kind of a coherent line in a world of modern technological innovation in which the physical nature of a particular machine or process is in fact going to be the defining characteristic. And if you start looking back at some of the earlier cases, the judges seem to understand this. They seem to recognize that if you require one of these physical connections, that people will start to draft their patents in stilted ways in an effort to satisfy the requirement. Chief Justice Roberts was quite correct, I think, in constantly asking whether or not when we do this sort of thing, whether what we're going to create in the end is a sort of an invitation for people to embroider into a patent, which is really part of information sciences, some kind of physical prerequisite, such as you have to enter this into a computer by typing on a key or something of the sort. And there really doesn't seem to be any particular reason to do this. So the large question that you therefore have to face is the one about the basic structure of the law. And that question, quite simply, is, are you so confident that, A, you could identify a class of what counts as business method patents, separate and apart from other kinds of patentable materials, first, and then second, that all the stuff that's built in this area is so unimportant with respect to general protection that you're quite happy to let it die on the vine? In order to do that, it's not looking at funny hypotheticals that matter. It's looking at a broad range of business method patents that have previously been granted and to ask yourself whether that indicates whether this entire field is a giant mistake. One of the dangers that one has if it turns out that they decide in Bielski to give a narrow definition of patent eligibility is nobody is really quite sure what's going to happen to the literally thousands of patents that have been granted in this business method state since the State Street case of 1998, which gave a generally strong endorsement to the patent eligibility of these things. It would be an uncommon mess to have all sorts of patents given, all sorts of licenses granted under these patents, all sorts of royalties paid under the licenses that have been previously granted, and then to discover that categorically all of these things are basically invalid. So what is it in sum that we really hope to achieve by looking at this particular area? And I think that, first of all, we would hope and pray that the Supreme Court would give a very narrow decision if, in fact, they're determined to exclude things from the scope of patent eligibility. But more importantly, I think, notwithstanding the fact that most of the questioning that was given to Mr. Jakes was of the skeptical, quizzical, bemused, and slightly hostile variety, that the justices will sit down in the cool of the evening, as it were, think about the implications of the system, understand the way the pieces fit together, and then recognize that this case may in fact be correctly decided on its facts if this particular hedging method is quote-unquote obvious and should be struck down on that ground, but will refrain from taking a step which I think would have massive dislocations at the time when this economy really needs every boost that it can get by taking the fatal step of knocking down and striking out as non-patent eligible all business method patents. So let's hope for once that this court is capable of doing the right thing. It has been highly negative with respect to patents in recent years. Every case which has been pro-patentee has lost. It's now time, I think, for a fairly sharp and decisive reversal.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at www.federalistsociety.org/multimedia.